Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
And good afternoon. Welcome to The Dividing Line Thursday afternoon, the last day of January. I can't believe the first month of the year is already over. And time goes by ever faster the older you get. But anyway, that's not meant depressingly. That's just sort of the way it is. Just a few moments ago, I posted a blog article on the blog, if you all want to go see it. And the blog article is about the Steve Gregg debate and the fact that as far as a person-to-person debate at Twin Lakes Church on March 30th, that has been called off. I called it off this morning. I won't go back over the 9 minutes worth of video I just posted, but I'll just summarize. It became very clear that there was going to be some there's going to be some issues as far as the church is concerned, and that's, I do not want to put a church in a situation with a debate on this subject that would be a problem for them. Since there was offense even over the blog article that I put up, I think it was less than a week ago, I know that much, where I noted some statements that Steve Gregg had made about me, and Steve has apologized for those. He indicates they were meant to be taken in a more lighthearted way, and but I had posted them on the blog. Some of the church had seen it, and it had caused quite a stir. And I figured if 2 months out, something that non-offensive and very tepid in comparison to what would take place during a debate, had caused that kind of a problem, that clearly this is not the appropriate context for a debate on this particular subject. I do not want to cause issues within the church there. And besides that, Steve Gregg and I both have, well, you're listening to The Dividing Line. He has, it's called The Narrow Path. And so we can obviously work out to where we can simulcast. You know, I can call into his program through our phone lines. We can have his program going out through our webcast and both record at the same time. And so we are going to find like a week where we can do that. And so I don't see anything lost there other than videotaping. And I don't think that's, you know, necessarily relevant to the issue. And we avoid all of the problems of offense for people and so on and so forth. So I put that up on the blog just before the program started. Would have gotten it up earlier, but it takes a while to upload videos. And even though my desk unit's got a fairly decent processor in it, you know, the higher quality video you try to go with, I even knocked this down a couple so it would be a little bit faster, so it would get done in time to get uploaded to the program. So before the program started. So that's there, and I hope. I do not see anybody saying, "Oh, see, you can't take on Steve Gregg," blah 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 blah. I really hope I don't see that. The facts are just so obvious, and I would like to think that even Steve would try to nip that in the bud, because we are going to do that encounter, and we're just going to have to do it in a different context that does not quite require as much. As many other people involved, shall we say. So hopefully that will work out. So I've already got some people griping in channel because they live up in California, and they're like, "Hey, finally!" And then, you know, but I will be up there in May. I'll be in that same neighborhood, I guess, for the fire conference. So I'll be speaking up there in May, as I recall. So, you know, we'll still get a chance to talk with folks. All right. With that, I will have to admit, this is certainly the most unusual beginning to a dividing line I've ever seen, because I just sat down and was getting stuff put together here on the laptop that I use for the program here in the studio, and the first call appearing on my screen here is an announcement to something that I had no knowledge of. So I'm just going to go ahead and see what happens here and talk with Nader Ahmed in Illinois. Nader, what's going on?
Oh, how you doing, James?
Doing all right. I see here on my screen something about the debate. What's going on?
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about the debate challenge which you posed to me on the reliability of the New Testament, which, of course, I accepted. And I think we are scheduled for, I think, March 21st. Well, I wanted to talk to you because, well, of course, I also want to debate the Quran, which is something, because, of course, our website, examinethetruth.com, is a Islamic debate website. But I was under the impression that we were just going to debate the reliability of the New Testament on the 21st. So, but if you want to debate both, that's fine with me. But I think I'm going to have to push the date ahead or behind or after the March 21st, basically, because it's going to take some time to prepare all the material for both debates.
Mr. Ahmed, I've made it very clear in the emails that I am more than happy to defend the integrity of the text of the New Testament. This week, you began attempting to establish rules for the debate that, in essence, presuppose my inability to stay on a topic. And in essence, you are asking that any discussion of the textual history of the Quran be precluded. And I said, first of all, I have done many debates, and I have a documented history that demonstrates that I know what the topic is, and I know how to stay on the topic. That's A. B, what I said was that any ancient text, any written ancient text, whether it's the Quran, Tacitus, the Mishnah, doesn't matter what it is. If the issue is the consistency of argumentation being used against the New Testament, then I can obviously point to any ancient text, whether it's the Quran or any other, as an example of the methodologies that are used in the transmission of a printed text. I have not asked you to debate the issue of the Quran. I have simply said that inserting unnecessary rules, which no other person I've ever debated on any subject, in any context, has ever demanded or asked for, other than you, is simply without any basis, since you cannot point to any situation where I have violated the debate rules and debates I have done, then you have no grounds for doing this. And so I simply said in my last email, look, if you want to debate your assertion that the New Testament is corrupted, and as you recall, when you came to my church on a Sunday evening, you said that you could easily demonstrate the corruption of the New Testament in about 6 minutes. You'd be given at least 20 here, which would be about three times more time than you said that you would need. So why you have a problem with that, I do not know. I don't know who.
I don't think you're understanding me. I mean, of course, you know, I'd love to debate both topics, but what I'm saying is it's going to be kind of tough for me to do it all in one topic, in one debate. See, the problem is if you're going to challenge the Quran's authenticity and say that there are, quote, textual variations, which is a big lie, of course, then, you know, I'm going to drop the topic on the Bible, and I'm going to challenge you on the Quran. And I can't do both in one debate. I said, if you want to debate the Quran or you want to challenge the authenticity of the Quran, let's do it.
Mr. Ahmed, all I have said, and any logical and rational person understands what I'm saying, and you're not acting logically or rationally here, and we are recording this, so I would be very measured in my terminology. What I have said, is that I will defend the integrity of the New Testament. And if you use any argument that is inconsistent with any ancient text, that is, that would require us to reject the textual integrity of any ancient text, including the Quran. And if you want to go, and if you want to go on record like you just did, in saying that there are no textual variations in the Quran, I think you just said that. I will be glad to provide the photographic evidence that demonstrates that you don't know what you're talking about. But be that as it may, if you want to use arguments against the New Testament that would demonstrate that the Quran is corrupted, then logically any rational person would want to know that you are using double standards, because the use of double standards is irrational and demonstrates that the person using them has lost the argument. Okay. I have not asked you to defend the Quran against any form of, in any debate. I have not asked you to do two debates on the subject. To say that I have is untrue. And, of course, not only you, but I both have all of, and Mr. Wood, all have the emails that have been exchanged. And if I have to waste my time posting them, I will. But I am not going to be limited in a debate to saying, well, okay, my opponent just made an argument that would actually contradict his own scriptures, but I can't say anything about it because he made me promise I wouldn't. I mean, that is absolutely ridiculous, sir.
No, okay, you're not understanding me. What I'm saying is, for this situation, can we do two debates, one on the Quran, one on the Bible,
sir,
so people can see if I'm using a double standard or not, which I believe I will not be doing.
Sir, we have a situation here where David Wood and others have arranging locations. As I understand, they already have five debates scheduled. Mm-hmm. They have room for one other, and that would be ours. Obviously, trying to arrange another debate in another location means more travel, means trying to come up with the shipping of video equipment and everything else. And in this period of time, that's not a possibility. If you want to do other debates, I've already mentioned to you at the very beginning that there is a debate that I want to do on Surah 4157, and I already have a context for that, and they are willing to do that in September of this year. So if you will be just but somewhat patient, there will be plenty of time to do as many as we can. But the idea of bailing out of March because of some idea of doing two debates or something like that, I haven't challenged you to do two debates. I've only challenged you to do one. And all I've said is I'm not going to have artificial rules placed upon me that says I can't point out double standards. If you use double standards, I'm going to point it out. If you don't, I won't have to. It's just that simple.
Okay. I don't think we're getting anywhere. So I tell you what, for this debate, all I'm trying to say here is that if you're going to raise something about the Quran, then I got to drop the topic of the Bible, and I got to start defending the Quran. And if that's what I have to do on March 21st, then fine, I will do that. I will not be using a double standard. The problem is, in your mind, you have been fooled into thinking that there's textual variations in the Quran when there is not, and I'm saying no, there's not. So now we're going to be debating.
Okay, let me ask you. Okay, Nadia, let me ask you something. How can I be fooled in my mind by the photographs of the palimpsest manuscripts like E20 that clearly show the standard forms of textual emendation that exist in the handwritten copies of the earliest Qurans? How does someone fool me into seeing that kind of material? Could you tell me?
Okay, so you want to debate me on this issue right now? Is that what you want? Okay,
No, sir. You said it's a lie, and you just made an assertion I've been fooled into it.
So
I'm just asking you, what kind of mechanism can fool me into seeing that kind of textual variation? I'm just wondering how that works.
All right, let me go ahead and squash this nonsense, which, by the way, you've been, you know, using against Shabir Ali, who is a dummy and doesn't defend Islam, and that's why I came to your church to tell you, well,
do yourself a favor.
Sure.
Shabir Ali is a well-spoken and intelligent man, and you really make yourself look very foolish when you call a man like Shabir Ali a dummy, sir. That, sir, and besides that, despite the fact that I obviously have tremendous disagreements with Shabir Ali, and I disagree very strongly with the forms of argumentation that he has used, Shabir Ali has never mistreated me during a debate. He has always been a gentleman. And his followers have never written to me calling me a coward and saying I was running away from him either. And so if we're talking about who is attractive to Islam, I just simply point out to you that the person who behaves in a way as Shabir Ali behaves is significantly more attractive to someone than someone who uses bullying tactics and calls people names.
Okay, well, let me just respond to that very quickly here. Who is going to represent Islam and who Muslims think should represent Islam is not going to be you, James White. It's going to be us. Okay, and I can show you several people. Tons of people. In fact, I talked to Shabir Ali about this, who say he doesn't know what the hell he's doing. I mean,
excuse me. Keep your language clean, sir. You'll be dropped immediately. Do you understand me?
Heck, he doesn't know what the heck he's doing, all right? So we're the ones who are going to choose who's going to represent Islam. And I talked to him about this. I said, dude, what are you doing? You just sit up there and you just let people use you as a punching bag where you won't defend the Quran. And you've seen that now in two debates. And you're telling me he's such a intelligent guy?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You are really making yourself look ridiculous here because
not as bad
people,
as you, James.
People listening to this who have listened to Shabir Ali are really wondering right now what color is the sky in your world?
Okay, let me tell you what color it is, okay? For example, inside the New Testament debate, you attacked the Quran and said that basically that Uthman burn the codices. We don't even know what the original Quran looks like. He doesn't even refute that. He did that in both debates. Inside the one which you just recently had with him on the cross, it took someone from the audience to defend the Quran. And then he's like, oh, yeah, well, you know.
Well, actually, the person in the audience recognized the citation of Sahih al-Bukhari and recognized that the specific terminology that I used was taken directly from a citation of Sahih al-Bukhari, and you are certainly aware of that.
Shall I refute the issue about what you're saying, that all the codices of the Quran was burnt by Uthman, therefore we don't
know
what the Quran is?
Excuse me, I never actually said that. What I said to those who have listened to the debate and who have read Sahih al-Bukhari is exactly what the text says, and that is that there was a group of people chosen by Uthman to gather from a number of different sources, from palm leaves, from the memories of the Khura, from the shoulder blades of camels, and various smooth stones and things like that. These were the sources that Sahih al-Bukhari itself lists that were used by these group of men in collating the Quran. Is that true?
Okay, well, let me now address this issue. But
is that true?
Well, can I explain?
It's a simple question. Is that true?
Well,
is that what Sahih al-Bukhari says?
Well, yes and no. There's more to it than what you just stated.
But it did state that, right?
Can I please respond, James? Thank you. Okay, first of all, the Quran was preserved by actually a very special miracle, and this is the miracle of Hafiz, in the sense that it is possible for a person to memorize the entire Quran from A to Z and basically lodge the entire book on their head. So that was also another medium, which is how the Quran was stored, not just on palm leaves or you know, the other issues which you were mentioning. Now, the thing which you have missed here...
Excuse me. Wait a minute. Yes, I did. You're calling my program, and you just wandered off from what I just said. Yes, I did mention the Qura. Did I not? Are those not the reciters of the Quran?
Can I please say something here? Now, let me show you why the whole issue about when you're bringing up Uthman, why that's a nonsensical argument, okay? Because at the time of whatever, when Uthman did what he did, the entire society had the Quran in their possession.
Really?
Yes.
Is that what al-Bukhari says?
Yes, absolutely.
Also, when al-Bukhari says that certain ayah were found in the memory of only one person, he was lying?
Okay, can I first let me respond to the issue about Uthman burning the text And then I will address the hadith which you just stated. So let me do one at a time over here, okay? Okay, so going back to the hadith about Uthman. It is impossible for Uthman to change the Quran when the entire society had it. Because if you read in Bukhari, you will see that as soon as the Quran ayat was revealed, it was given to the vast majority of the people, the good, the bad, the ugly. They all had this Quran with them. So when it's in the hands of the people, one person can't change that book. So when you come in your debate and you say, oh, some, or insinuate whether you articulated it or in exactly this way or not, probably not, but this is what you insinuated, that the Quran was changed by Uthman, and therefore we don't know what the Quran looked like before Uthman, is a bogus argument. Okay, so that's what I wanted to correct you on.
Okay, well, first of all, you obviously do not even understand the presentation I've made. Have you read my CRI articles on this subject?
I have studied so much on this issue. I've debated this issue.
Have you read my articles on this subject in the CRI Journal?
No, I've heard your debates.
Okay, actually, I've not debated this subject.
What you mentioned with Shabir Ali, who wouldn't defend it.
So a question in passing. Okay, so you haven't read the articles, you don't know what I said. All right. Let me see if I can explain here. First of all, what I said was that when you have a revision such as you have in this context that involves the destruction of the preceding material, then from a textual critical perspective, if that destruction was completely successful, and there is question as to whether it was, or even if it took place at that particular point in time, but even if it was successful at that particular point in time, what that does is it freezes the text at that point, but it precludes the ability to go beyond that point to be able to examine the reality and the perfection of that particular collation. I was speaking from textual critical grounds, sir, at that point, and I think many people, especially Islamic scholars, would recognize that that is the case. Secondly, you have asserted but have not demonstrated the idea that everyone in the society had memorized the entirety of the Quran. There is absolutely no basis for this whatsoever. And in fact, Sahih al-Bukhari contradicts this because the reason for the collation is the differences in the recitations taking place amongst the Muslims. They do not want to be like the Christians and Jews and have differences over their text. And this leads then to the collation. And they were concerned because of the death of the Qura in the battle that had just taken place. Many of them had passed away, and so they recognized, man, if we lose any more of these folks, we might lose portions of the Quran. So obviously, it was not the concept found in Sahih al-Bukhari that everyone in the society possessed the entirety of the Quran.
Well, I think you've thrown a lot of points at me, so let me just tackle one at a time over here. Okay, first of all, what I said, they had possession of the Quran. There are some people who memorized the entire Quran from A to Z. There are some people who had maybe 50% lodged in their head, or at least to a certain amount. So I didn't say that everybody had memorized the Quran. So I think you're attacking a straw man over there. But the situation is this, which you cannot refute, and no one's going to – it's impossible for anybody to change a book when the society of people have that. And when you look in Bukhari, you will see so many examples of even the fuqara, the poor people, memorizing, learning, and teaching the Quran to others. So in that situation, no, you can't change the Quran.
Okay? Two things. First of all, it's interesting to me that as I sit here looking at Sahih al-Bukhari, Umar has come to me and said, casualties were heavy among the Qura of the Quran on the day of the Battle of Yamama. And I am afraid that more heavy casualties may take place among the Qura on other battlefields, whereby a large part of the Quran may be lost. Was Abu Bakr just not as smart as you, Nader?
Well, first of all, Abu Bakr is not contradicting anything what I'm saying. He's actually confirming exactly what I'm saying, that this is a time when the Quran was in the hands of the people. It was never restricted to just a small group of people. Now, the thing about Abu Bakr and people like that, when they took this action, they were being proactive. They didn't take this action when the problem has, you know, spiraled out of control and all of a sudden they're having a shortage. That's your interpretation that you're imposing on the text. Okay, they never reach to that level. They are not incompetent people.
So let me ask you.
Well, let me finish my point here, James. So what they're saying is before this becomes a problem, okay, where all of a sudden we don't have enough hafiz or hufaz inside the Muslim world, let's just take these preventive measures. Because, of course, they're the leaders of society. So, no, we've never had a hafiz shortage, if you will.
So Surah 9, 128 through 129, which was found in the memory of only one person, Can you explain how that fits with your theory that the Quran was the possession of all people?
Sure. I'll go to that hadith in just a second, but just to summarize what my contention was here, what I've shown you is that it is impossible for Uthman to, quote, change the Quran or tamper with it. Now, whether you were intentionally trying to hint at that, I don't know. But
no, where have I ever even suggested that Uthman edited the material that was there? My question has always been on the viability of the collection methodology, the fact that you have certain surah, certain ayah that are found in the memory of only one person, even after the initial collation, they later find another that was in the memory of only one person that had been forgotten. That's exactly, I'll read it if you need me to. Mm-hmm. And then I have another question. I think I heard you say that a book could never be changed when it's in the possession of all the people or something like that.
Correct.
That, yeah, so why would you say the New Testament's been changed when it clearly was in the possession of all the New Testament people?
Let me go to the hadith that you're quoting about, you know, where it was in the possession of one person. Then I'll get to the New Testament, okay? Because mm-hmm. that's actually what we're supposed to be debating, New Testament, which is on the 21st, okay? But now the hadith which you're referring to, mm-hmm. again, you are imposing your understanding on this text. First of all, the people who, I think it was Zayd, who he sent to go and, you know, verify this with each and every verse with another person. But he didn't go to the common people. That was not the minhaj, the methodology of the people of that time. They would only go to the scholars and the people of knowledge. And that was only in his locality. He never left his locality. Okay, so what you're imposing on the text is that nobody inside the Islamic world knew of this verse, which is not true. It didn't state that. If this was a situation, then it would clearly, explicitly say that. So that's your own interpretation you're imposing on the text.
So I started looking for the Quran and collecting it from what was written on palm stalks, thin white mm-hmm. stones, and also from the men who knew it by heart, till I found the last verse is Surat At-Taba, Repentance, mm-hmm. with Abi Kazami al-Ansari, and I did not find it with anybody other than him, and that mm-hmm. verse is, and then it is quoted, "Verily has come unto you an apostle Muhammad from amongst yourselves. It grieves him that you should receive any injury or difficulty till the end of Surat Bara'ah 9:128-129. Then the complete manuscripts, copy of the Quran, remained with Abu Bakr till he died, then with Umar till the end of his life, and then with Hafsa, the daughter of Umar." And then it goes on and talks about what happens when there is a difference amongst people who were quoting the Quran differently. Hudayfa was afraid of the people of Sham and Iraq, differences in the recitation of the Quran. So he said to Uthman, "O chief of the believers, save this nation before they differ about the book, the Quran, as Jews and Christians did before." So there was a concern. Why would there be a concern if there was not differences already existent? And so Uthman sent a message to Hafsa saying, "Send us the manuscripts of the Quran, so we may compile the Quranic materials in perfect copies and return the manuscripts to you." Hafsa sent it to Uthman. Uthman then ordered Zaid bin Thabit, Abdullah bin Azuzaibar, Sa'id bin Alas, and Abdurrahman bin Harith bin Hisham to rewrite the manuscripts in perfect copies. Uthman said to the three Quraishi men, "In case you disagree with Zaid bin Thabit on any point in the Quran, then write it in the dialect of Quraysh." The Quran was revealed in their tongue. They did so, and when they had written many copies, Uthman returned the original manuscripts to Hafsa. Uthman sent to every Muslim province one copy of what they had copied, and ordered that all the other Quranic materials, whether written in fragmentary manuscripts or whole copies, be burnt. Sa'id bin Thabit added, "A verse from Surat Azab was missed by me when we copied the Quran, and I used to hear Allah's apostle reciting it. So we searched for it, and found it with Kazami bin Thabit al-Ansari. The verse was, 'Among the believers are men who have been true in their covenant with Allah.'" That would be Surah 33, Ayah 23 is that one. So that one had been missed even in the preceding collation of the Quranic materials. And the assertion that I have made from the beginning is not that Uthman was sitting around going, "Let's see, or what can we change here, or what can I take out or put in or anything else." My assertion has been that from a textual critical perspective, the destruction of the preceding materials used to create the collation itself is the exact opposite concept that we have in the New Testament, where Christians are always looking for earlier and earlier manuscripts. And that therefore, if he was successful, and I think there's reason to believe that he was not, but if he was successful, if there was an Uthmanic revision that took place around 653 AD, that would preclude the kind of textual critical research that New Testament scholars are so excited about in finding earlier and earlier papyri manuscripts. It would freeze the text at that point, and in essence, all you could do would be to trace it back to Uthman and not to a period before Uthman. And if my understanding is correct, the last of the apostles was Muhammad, not Uthman. Yes?
I'm sorry, what was the last question?
That's okay. I think everybody else heard it. So what about the New Testament? Since you had said that a book that is in the possession of the people cannot possibly be changed.
Sure.
Books such as the Gospel of John, the earliest papyri manuscript we have is from around 125 AD. It's called P52, which, interestingly enough, is from John chapter 18, which is just a little bit after John 14 and 16, where many people try to say the original reading was not parakletos, but perikluptos, and was a prophecy of Muhammad. How then could that kind of change be made in the New Testament if you are being consistent in the assertions you made about the Quran?
Okay, well, you know, you bombarded me with a lot of stuff on the Quran, and I think there's something I got to respond to, at least some of that.
I just read Al-Bukhari, didn't I?
I know. Well, can I please respond to that?
Well, if you want to respond Al-Bukhari, but don't blame me for bombarding you. I'm just letting the listening audience has not read Al-Bukhari,
okay.
Nader.
Well, let me just respond to that so that, you know, we're all as clear as mud on what is being stated over there. Okay, this thing that the verse of the Quran was limited to only one person inside the entire Islamic world, we don't have any evidence for that. Okay, when the scribe was searching, he didn't even leave his locality, and he never said that this is only with one person inside the entire Islamic world. Once again, you are imposing that upon the text, and that contradicts other hadith, which states very clearly that there were many huffaz, there were many hafiz, meaning people who have memorized the Quran from the beginning to the end. Okay.
And where did the hadith ever say that those individuals were involved in the actual production of Uthman's text?
Okay, well, let me just go back to the thing about the scribe, okay? And so I'm trying to tell you that to sit and say that there was one verse of Quran that was limited to, well, actually two people, Zayd and the other person, that's not true. Okay, there's no evidence for that.
No, I'm not going to let you misrepresent me, sir. What I said was that the hadith said that for the production of Uthman's copy of the Quran, which became the standard, there was only one person. If you want to say other people knew that verse, fine, say that, but that's irrelevant to the production of Uthman's revision.
Okay, so you see, but here is the problem now. Then talking about Uthman's revision, talking about, you know, they just finding that one verse, none of this challenges the integrity of the Quran. Okay, this is all irrelevant. What we're seeing here is that this is all irrelevant information you're giving me. Now, I thought you were going to actually challenge the authenticity of the Quran.
It's
at least all
irrelevant. Let me just make sure everybody in the listening audience knows. The key hadith section in the most respected hadith collection, Sahih al-Bukhari, the primary one that deals with the actual collation of the text of the Quran, was just said to be irrelevant. I just want to make sure everybody caught that,
well,
because sometimes you might not hear those things. I just want to make sure everyone catches that.
If
it
you
is
allow me to,
irrelevant.
Well, let me explain. I explained what I was trying to say very clearly. It's irrelevant to the issue of trying to say or trying to prove that the Quran is corrupt. This material that you're quoting doesn't prove a squat if someone wants to challenge the integrity of the Quran. That's what I was trying to refer to. Of course, we respect these hadiths, and of course, Bukhari is a very reliable source. So anyways, having said that, you know, it's very, like I said, once the book is in the hands of the vast majority of people, and the society has it, then one person can change it. It's impossible to change. Now, when it comes to the New Testament, which I think is now what you are, your second question was, well, when did we ever have this situation? When the New Testament was in the hands of the society of people, and they had it. It was maybe 300 to 400 years after Jesus.
Really?
Yeah.
wow, so all of those eyewitnesses and the apostles, they just sat around on their hands. They never preached about Jesus. They never traveled all over the world. Paul never actually made it to Ephesus, and Luke never went to Rome. And all these far-flung places where eyewitnesses, as late as the time of John, were preaching and teaching the message of Christ, they didn't have anything until 300 or 400 years later. Is that the idea?
Okay, well, see, everything which you quoted, you were restricting the New Testament in the minority of just one or two people. But the question which you raised to me is when the society, meaning thousands upon thousands of people, have the New Testament, the 27 books of the New Testament.
Have to be the 27 books of the New Testament?
Okay, well, let me finish my point here. That's when I say, no, you cannot corrupt the New Testament once it has reached this stage. Okay, now, if you're saying, okay, well, what about 26 books, or what about
What is contained in manuscript P46?
P46, I don't know. I would have to look it up.
Okay, in manuscript P46, when you look through, for example, Paul's epistles, you find that P46 is a collection of Paul's epistles. Do you have any idea when that existed, when it was written?
Like I said, I would have to look it up. I don't know the dates offhand.
It's around the year 200, and already Paul's epistles have been collected into a single collection of separate books put together in one book of the writings of Paul the Apostle. This is around 200. And so these books exist, first of all, in each of the places where his epistles were sent to. So you'd have Ephesus, and you have Thessalonica and Philippi and places like that. And so they're far flung, and then they are brought together into one collection. Could you give us an idea of how something like that could have been corrupted? That's consistent with the arguments you've already used of people allegedly having memorized all of the Quran. Didn't people memorize things before the 7th century in Arabia? Didn't other societies also memorize things?
Absolutely. People memorized things. But what you have to understand, when we talk about the memorization of the Quran, this, what I told you, is a special miracle or phenomenon which is just unique to the Quran in the sense that it is easy for a person to memorize this book, so much so to the point that even in today's time, you have like 7-8-year-old kids who have memorized the entire Quran from A to Z. So there's something very special about this book, and that's why you cannot compare it with other memorizations of other texts and stuff like that. There's something different about
it. So the ease of the ability to memorize the Quran is why it couldn't be changed, but the New Testament could be because it's not as easy to memorize?
Did people take the New Testament from its inception, memorize every single word, and then spread this knowledge among hundreds upon hundreds of people at its inception?
You know, it's very interesting, Nader, that a lot of people were willing to die rather than give up their scriptures for about 270 years under Roman rule, very different than the Quran, where no one had to die under Islamic rule for the Quran because it was under the control of the leaders of the empire itself, the caliphate. And so, interestingly enough, I would think people who were willing to actually give their lives for those texts would probably know what those texts actually contained. Yeah, I think they would. But very interesting that the reason that the people possessing the Quran means it could not have been changed. It's different for the Christians because of a miracle about how much easier the Quran is to memorize. Okay, well,
Can I say one quick thing?
Yeah.
You see, that the reason why I called on this show is because, as you can see, we just had pretty much, a 20, 30-minute debate on the Quran. And what I'm saying is, if you're going to challenge the Quran, this is exactly what's going to happen, where, of course, we're going to debate on this issue, and that's the reason why I was trying to explain to you. Let's try to break it up into two different debates. Do you understand where I was trying to go with this?
Well, I understand that, in essence, what you want to do on the 21st is to say that I can't mention the Quran. And once again, if your argumentation in regards to your allegations of the corruption of the New Testament do not involve arguments that include a double standard, then there is no reason to even mention the Quran.
Okay.
That's all there is to it.
That's not a problem. And I already told you that the whole issue about, you know, textual corruption, which is actually Bart Ehrman's game, I'm not going to raise that. Okay? And I'm going to raise other issues when it comes for this debate. So, okay, I think, you know, I think we see eye to eye. It took us about 40 minutes of banging heads, but I think we've actually come to a conclusion on something here.
All righty, sir. So, I imagine David was probably listening or will be listening, so we'll just go from there. But thank you for your call today.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye. I guess we missed the break, huh? Looking at Rich in the other room. It's been a bit of a different day, hasn't it, Rich? Okay, well, you never know what's under those blinking lights when you turn on the phones and say, call us! You never know what's going to be there. Wow, okay. All right. I don't know. John and Ogden, hey, why don't we just completely strip the gears out of the transmission here and forget about the clutch and let's talk with John and Ogden about Mormon liturgy. Hey, John.
Hey, how are you doing?
Do you have any idea what you were just listening to?
I tried to catch most of it, but... I just got out of a long day of school, so I'm kind of putting it off.
What can we do for you today, John?
Well, anyways, hopefully on a lighter note, I guess somewhat in light of the recent death of Gordon B. Hinckley,
Can I mention to folks, they may not even be aware of this, Gordon B. Hinckley, prophet of the Mormon Church, passed away a couple days ago. And the next, allegedly, supposed to be, I mean, they like to keep you all guessing, but Monson is supposed to be the next prophet. I'm not sure if he's been, when that takes place, stuff like that. But just so people know what you're referring to. Yes, go ahead, sir.
Well, I'm a student at Weber State University up here, and this is my last semester. And they have the LDS Institute of Religion next to every campus down mm-hmm. here. So I thought I'd take one of their free classes, and it's a class on Acts of Revelation. And I thought a New Testament class would be interesting just to see how they even read it.
No kidding, yeah.
So.
Well, now, are you not a native Utahan?
Since I was 14, I've been living here.
Okay.
And so that's 10-some-odd years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But now I, let's see, I noticed a lot of the class so far has been, everything they point out in the New Testament so far has been related to church structure and church offices and whatnot, and a lot of it's just avoiding any theological matters, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to point out the second part of Acts chapter 1
mm-hmm.
Speaks of the replacing of Judas, essentially, and when they read this, they kind of took it as kind of a type text for how to replace an apostle or someone who has passed away, and I guess even the president.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Well, I guess I just wanted to clarify what's going on kind of in this passage. Is it just even relevant only to Judas' replacement?
Yes, I think it is for a couple of reasons. First of all, it specifically makes a reference to the fact that an apostle has to be one who was there from the beginning, was an eyewitness to the ministry of Jesus. And you never see this being repeated again. My understanding of the text, to be honest with you, I know many people don't view it this way, but I do not believe Matthias was the 12th apostle. I believe Paul was, and casting of lots is sounds to me more like Peter's idea of keeping the club together than it is God's idea of who his man was for that job. And so I don't even look at that as an example of anything more than primitive idea of we need to keep this group together, but that's not God's idea. He splits them up. The whole first 9 chapters is how God, in essence, chases the Christians out of Jerusalem, and they start to spread across the world. So I don't see that as providing any kind of paradigm for really anything at all. And there's no, certainly the early church does not pick up on that or continue to utilize that in any meaningful fashion down the road. But I would comment, it is fascinating to me. I have one tiny little paperback work in my library of notes on the Book of Romans from a Mormon. I do not believe we will ever see a meaningful scholarly commentary on the Book of Romans from a Mormon, because they can't enter into the milieu of the monotheistic religion that was Paul's and engage the text in any meaningful fashion. Doesn't mean Mormons can't learn Greek and everything, they can. But the New Testament is so far removed from Joseph Smith and his theology that this is the pressure that we're seeing at BYU and other higher institutions of learning these days, is these people come in from getting their PhDs someplace else, and they're stretched between, you know, you go read Joseph Smith and his comments about the Bible, and they're just so far removed from anything that could be relevant to the truth, that trying to do meaningful exegesis and scholarship, it's just not possible for a polytheist to do that with the New Testament. And I don't know what's going to happen to Mormonism. You may be up there now. You're up in a more conservative. Where is Weaver State located again?
We are approximately 30 some odd miles north of Salt Lake.
Okay, yeah. You can see what's going on up there. I mean, you're young enough that you can't go back to the 80s and have a comparison at that point, but I can. And let me tell you something. This is not your grandfather's Mormonism anymore. And it's fascinating to see the old existing right next to the new, and Mormonism has really seemed to have lost its direction. I don't know if Monson at 80 can reverse that, or if you would even have the support within the hierarchy to do that. I don't know. Right. I do not know where Mormonism is going to end up, but it is fascinating to observe it. No question about it.
Okay, can I add one more comment on that first?
Yeah, sure, real quick.
Okay, the booklet that goes along with this actually has a story about a couple of missionaries asking somebody, or saying something about the apostles being necessary today, and the minister they were talking to responded saying that pretty much exactly that the apostle had to be a witness of all things pertaining to the mission and resurrection of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And the, I guess, state president or whatnot tells him to go back and ask him where the Apostle Paul gained his witness to those things.
Well, yeah. It's called The Road to Damascus,
right.
You know, in essence.
And
but
why, I guess, how did he gain testimony sufficient to be an apostle, and how does he know that all who are today apostles are not likewise receivers of that witness?
right, yeah. Well, yeah, that's exactly what I've heard. I've had Mormons tell me, honestly, that every single apostle has had a physical vision of Jesus.
Yes, that's what I've been told as well. I was surprised.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah, that's what I've been told. So that's pretty consistent. All righty, John.
All right, well, I appreciate the time.
Okay, thank you for calling. God bless. Bye-bye. All right, let's continue on to New Jersey. Talk with David. Hi, David.
You there?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I want to switch things back to Islam, if I can do that. And take it in a different direction, but I say this with all somberness and sobriety because it's a very serious topic. But, I mean, you as an elder and as someone who gives pastoral advice, how would you advise Christians to deal with the militant threat of Islam? Not just the apologetics, not all that, but it almost seems like an affront to the persecution that's going on against Christians and other religious minorities as well. To sometimes even engage in this, because in Muslim lands, this can't be done.
That's right.
And so I'm just thinking, like, when it comes to dealing with Muslims, like, where is the line where you would say you shouldn't do that? You know, is, like, something like what happened in Bosnia, Serbia, is that going too far, and why? And
well,
is there too far when you're dealing with an enemy that will basically stop at nothing until there is just Dar al-Islam.
Yeah. The Dar al-Islam versus Dar al-Hab. One of the reasons, you know, I would much rather engage individuals like Yasser Qadhi or Hamza Yusuf or Shabir Ali than people like Nader Ahmed, mainly because there's just a massive difference between them in their approach their knowledge of background materials, their ability to reason and to be consistent. But the reason that I do is because it is that kind of argumentation that our persecuted brothers and sisters in other lands are experiencing day in and day out as their beliefs are mocked and attacked by the Muslim majorities. And so to provide responses to them and to demonstrate the inconsistencies and to demonstrate the consistency of the Christian faith over against that is useful to those people who live in Iraq, in Syria, in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia and Iran and places like that. And it is not tasteful to me in any way, shape or form. But honestly, I will continue to do it because I know that I do have persecuted brothers and sisters, and those people are facing individuals who are using that kind of argumentation. And if I can give them any kind of encouragement or any kind of example of, in the face of that kind of irrationality, how to respond to it, I will do so, because I do regularly pray for our brothers and sisters in other lands who are experiencing a persecution at the hands of Muslims. And I do believe it's apologetically relevant to point out that we can only have this kind of conversation outside of the Dar al-Islam, outside right. of those, outside of where Sharia law has been established. And I think it is. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, and where I was going with that is more along the lines of, it seems to me, and I'm not in any way taking away what you're doing because it's very much needed, but I'm saying there seems to be a point, and I say this not crass, but just as blunt as I can to get the point across, but there seems a point to end the debate and pick up a gun. Now, I'm not saying that's your job.
No, I don't think so. I really don't.
I'm just thinking, like, what you posted on, you know, your blog where you had Mr. Was it Shimon?
Yeah, debated, Sam Shimon. Uh-huh.
The man that just called. And he said that there's, at the end, he closed, and the people who can go there and watch it said that it's not, and he listed a couple things, that this is not what will stop Islam, but it will be the message of Jesus Christ.
Right.
And I would say I agree, but in part. I mean, it seems to me, this from a sociological, cultural perspective, the reason why there is a Christianity and people know about it and not Zoroastrianism is because Christianity at one point took up the sword to defend.
No, I don't believe so. No,
you
I
don't believe so.
No, I don't believe so. I know that historically, historically, David, there has been those nations that called themselves Christian. But I do not believe that I think what you're doing here is you're confusing the way that Christians are to respond to attacks upon their faith and the way that a nation is to respond to attacks upon its national identity.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is an appropriate fashion whereby a nation can defend itself against enemies, both foreign and domestic.
And what would that be? That's what I'm asking you. I mean, I know that's not
but
exactly
but
your
I'm,
thing.
But see, I don't believe in the concept of a quote-unquote Christian nation either.
Right, I would even agree, but what I'm saying is, whether it be on a nationalistic level or whether it be Christians on their own or in some kind of, I guess you could say militia or whatever, but some type of armed group, what would be, I guess you could say, an appropriate response, even by, if you would take, you know, people that aren't even Christians, you know, if you're talking about like a secular nation like, you know, the U.S. military, and that's comprised of people who are Christian, but those who also aren't.
Well, that's,
how
that's
far is too far to go, if there's such a thing?
Well, I do not want any nation's military thinking that its job is the promulgation, expanse, and defense of the gospel. The gospel is not defended by those means. The weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh. We change hearts. We don't carry guns for that. Now, I believe that there's two different realms here. I will protect myself and my family against evil men who would seek to attack them and to hurt them. And if a Christian believes that they can serve in the military to defend their nation, more power to them. And I think that that's a biblical position to take, because Jesus spoke to John the Baptist spoke to those who were in the military, and he did not tell them to get out of the military. I do not believe that you can really defend the concept of pacifism from the New Testament the way
right,
it's been taken
right.
by some people. But there is a, I think, a very firm line that has to be drawn between the appropriate existence of military in defense of a nation, and then likewise my duties as a husband and a father to protect my wife and my children and my family and myself against evil men who would seek to attack and kill me, and then the idea of Christians gathering together and utilization of weapons to somehow engage in some sort of military effort to attack a particular religious group that wants to attack us or something like that. That's a completely different concept
in
my mind.
Some, I would agree with you, but in some areas that's not possible. I mean, take like the situation in parts of Africa where there's no one coming to the rescue. The people that are being attacked are predominantly Christian. So it would naturally be Christians or maybe some group along with Christians that come together, but that say, hey, you know, we can either get squashed out of existence or we can go on a proactive, preemptive strike. And that seems to me to be biblically acceptable.
Well,
and
what was Jesus' statement to the Christians who would find themselves in the environs of Jerusalem when God's judgment came upon that city? Do you remember?
I'm guessing they're saying, like, you know, flee to the hills, like a Judea. Is it that one?
That is what Jesus said to the believers in Jerusalem. He did not say band together and fight the Romans. And I do hear what you're saying, and there's a part of me that says, yeah, go get them. But there's also a part of me that goes, wait a minute. Fundamentally, the vindication of the Christian people who are being slaughtered by Muslims in Africa today is an eternal vindication. And that is difficult sometimes for us to accept. But the reality is that the persecution of Christians has been going on all the way through the history of the church. The faces of the persecutors and their purposes change, but that persecution has been going on. And it is the fact that those individuals refused in essence, take up arms when people were saying deny Christ. That ended up changing every society that did persecute them eventually. And all those nations and all those peoples have passed. When you go into the history, they've all passed from the face of this earth. Anybody who has ever done that, any of those nations in ancient history have been destroyed, and either that or eventually conquered by people who ceased that persecution or even adopted a generally Christian outlook on the world. I don't have easy answers for these things, but I can tell you that the AK-47, the M16 is not the answer. But bold Christians who know their faith and the blessing of the Holy Spirit of God in changing the hearts and minds of those Muslims who are giving vent to those very human and evil intentions of promoting their religion through external means. That is really the only weapon of mass instruction that's going to bring peace to the Middle East. I think is the missionary efforts of changing hearts and minds. And I understand the impatience that can exist when we see unjust persecution, but that is the reality of the situation we face, and we have to trust that God has a purpose in it. David, thank you very much for your patience and your phone call. Dan, sorry we weren't able to get to you today, but it was certainly, without a doubt, one of the most unusual dividing lines we have ever done. But that's what happens when you open the phone lines. I'm going to tell you something. There's almost no place you can go on the internet to hear stuff like you hear here. Thanks for listening, folks. Who knows what'll be the next time, but be there or you'll miss it. God bless. We need a new reformation.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracts. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.